This is Sharon Bornholt of Innovative Property Solutions and the author of the Louisville Gals Real Estate blog, and I am honored to have the opportunity to interview Mitch Steven today. Mitch is the author of what has become one of my favorite books on real estate, My Life in 1,000 Houses. Mitch has been investing in real estate since 1996, and I think you will find his story intriguing. He is a self-employed high school graduate, and he is a self-taught entrepreneur. He's just a normal guy that has finally seen all of his hard work pay off. What I love about Mitch's book, My Life in 1,000 Houses, is that he's so willing to share his struggles as well as his successes. It's pretty typical for new investors to expect success to come much quicker than it usually does. Everyone makes it seem so easy. One thing you will definitely learn from this book is that it's not always easy. There will be many struggles along the way, but Mitch has consistently proven that you can be successful in any real estate market, and you don't need any money to buy real estate. Welcome, Mitch.
How are you doing, Sharon?
I'm great.
I'm glad to be here. We got some sunshine down here in San Antonio, Texas. Finally, the days are lightening up on us, and we're probably ahead of most people. So
you are
in the weather department.
I'm pretty jealous here, sitting in rainy Louisville, Kentucky.
Let me first
start out, Mitch, by saying that I love the way your book is written. The first part of the book is chronological, and it depicts the maturing of a young businessman. The second half of the book consists of 18 random stories, which I thought was very unique. It was a definite shifting of the gears. I was wondering, how did you think to break the book up in such a clever way?
Well, you know, I didn't contemplate a lot. I'm a ready, fire, aim kind of guy. So I got something I want to do. I just start doing things. And then, typical to form, I find out that I've done them in the wrong order or I've done them the wrong way. And then I learn by falling down, hence the subtitle of my book, Failing Forward to Financial Freedom. I learn by falling down, getting back up and saying, well, that didn't work. So when I started, I really didn't start out to write a book. I just started to think about all the crazy things that have happened to me, all the good things, all the bad things, all the really funny things that happened to me on this journey. I thought, you know, I'm going to start writing these stories as I think of them. And then I started writing them down. You know, I'd be in my car, in my truck, and I'd be writing down these titles of these stories. And I was going to do like 55 stories. I ended up having like 55 stories, you know, that I had written. And then I was going over them, and I was just going to publish a book of real estate investor stories from a guy who was out there doing it. And then it dawned on me that the stories are not going to really mean a lot to someone if they don't know where I came from and what I did and what kind of shoes I was wearing when I walked on that path, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to kind of chronicalize what I had done, and I found out that I just really didn't even know where to start. And so I just said, well, I guess I'll start from the beginning.
Well, I think
and
you
I really
did.
I think you did it just right. I did it.
Yeah. Well, it all came together great. I think, however you did it, and I think it's important for people to understand that you don't always have to know exactly where you're going when you start with your writing. Most investors I know didn't start out in real estate. They either had a job or another business. They may have even had a well-paying job. A good friend of mine was an ex-police officer. For him, there was a defining moment when he decided to pursue real estate investing full-time. Was there a defining moment for you, or was it a decision that you made over time?
There were some defining moments that led to the decision over time. You know, there were several defining moments. There was a defining moment when I was working very hard, and I was making a lot of money, and I wasn't getting compensated, you know, nearly what I thought I was worth. And I understood their predicament. You know, they had to watch the bottom line and stuff, but one of the defining moments was I decided no job, eat. And that was one of my first goals ever. And I don't write a lot of goals, but I wrote that goal, no job, eat. And I've got to tell you, that goal scared me to death. And so a wise man once told me that the human body, this man was a POW over in Cuba. He got captured in the Bay of Pigs as a traitor to his country. He was put in Castro's hotel for 2.5 years. But they did some god-awful things to him. And he said that the human body is the most adaptable thing in the world. And if you'll just give it enough water and enough protein, and if the mind doesn't go, it will survive almost anything. And wow. I took that what he said, and I thought, well, if the body really is the most adaptable thing in the world, which I believed it was, if I take being employed off the table, this body will have to figure it out. And I just strapped myself to that thing. And I learned how to make $8 an hour by myself. And then I learned, you know, every morning it's like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then I learned how to make $8 an hour. And then I figured out something to make $10 an hour. And then I figured out how to make that into 15 and then 25 and then 50 and then $100 an hour. And, you know, in my biggest year, I think I was worth $800 an hour.
Wow.
Which, by the way, didn't make my wife that happy on some occasions, because she'd say, could you drop off the laundry on your way? And I say, look, I'm worth $800 an hour. Can you find someone else to do it?
That's a great story, by the way.
She didn't appreciate it at the time, but she, you know, I said, man, there's got to be someone else that can do this. I've got other things I got to do.
Well, you had a lot of jobs and businesses before diving into real estate. How did all those other ventures help prepare you for what would become a successful career in real estate investing?
Well, that was some more of the other defining moments that happened. I mean, one time in my career, I sold my drum set for $750, and I bought a striping machine because I read somewhere that in Entrepreneur magazine that I could make some money putting yellow and white lines on parking lots.
Mm-hmm.
And in about 3 years after I started, I grossed $1.7 million, and all my accounts were paid up because I kind of went cash as I went, but I had all these accounts receivables. And then the recession of 86 hit, and everybody filed bankruptcy on me, and I had $350,000 in accounts receivable and no bills, and I didn't get paid on almost any of it. And I had been kind of dabbling in real estate and liked it, but never thought that I had the wherewithal to make any money at it. But I had a couple of little places that I never rented. I always owned my own place. It was a tiny little condo that I bought for $25,000 or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when I sold it, I made more money in that one day than I made in my whole job for the whole year. And at about the same time, I wasn't getting paid for the services I did. And I recognized in real estate that if people didn't pay me, I could get something back at least. You know, I had some kind of retribution. Uh-huh. In the service industry, I couldn't take back my service hardly. Like in this case, I couldn't take back the lines off the parking lot. So I learned that if you function inside the real estate law, natural laws, not legal laws, but the natural laws of business and real estate, that if you stay within certain boundaries, if someone doesn't pay you, you can still get made whole.
Mm-hmm.
And that really appealed to me a lot. You know, I had contemplated going to Nashville and being a professional songwriter. You got to remember, this is in my early 20s. I'm now 50. But I went down to Nashville and was trying to learn the music business, and, you know, you get paid 3 cents every time your song is played on the radio, and I thought, who keeps track of that, and how do I know? And so I skipped that.
Wow, you know? Exactly, yeah.
I was trying to find something that if I did the work that I could make sure I got paid.
So your circumstances actually kind of led you to this path, you know, and may not have been where you thought you were going, but you ended up certainly in the right place then.
Well, there was another defining moment when someone was doing my tax returns, and I had a couple of little rent houses, and the CPA, you know, handed me my tax return, and she says, why are you bartending and doing all this other stuff? I mean, you need to be in real estate. Look at your report. And, you know, I made more money in real estate in a fraction of my time than I did at my job.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was another kind of aha moment where I sat down and I said, I think she's right. You know, I think she's right. I think I need to look at what I'm doing.
The wise CPA there. A lot of real estate investors have a tough time when they're first getting started. I know you had some tough times. You know, especially the first few years seem to be tough for folks. The learning curve is just so high that a lot of people throw in the towel before they figure it out. What made you keep going in spite of all your setbacks?
I just had a, the main thing, and I think the main thing anyone has to have for anything that they get involved in, they have to have a passion, and I just had a passion for it. I liked owning things, and at first I liked owning them, like my first condo. I was bartending and working on, you know, the entrepreneurial endeavor of the day at day and bartending at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought my condo because I wanted to be able to say, you know, that's mine. You know, you remember when your parents used to say, this is my roof, and if you don't like the rules, you can get out. Well, I wanted my roof, mm-hmm. where I could make the rules. And I really started buying real estate just because I wanted to own it. But as things happened to me, you know, I bought another place that was a little bit bigger, and I got a roommate, and I rented out the other place, and pretty soon I learned I was living for free. I learned this by accident. Really, it was kind of common sense. I wanted a bigger place. My other place was paid for. My little condo, I'd paid for it, and so I thought, well, I'll just move a renter into this one, and then I'll get a two-bedroom place, and I'll rent out the room. You know, I'll get a roommate and rent it out to him, and then I'll own two places. I won't have a payment, and that was really good for a long time.
Yeah, that's very smart.
I didn't, you know, I mean, I had read this stuff in books. Like, I read Robert Allen's Nothing Down, and really one of the biggest and the strongest defining moment in my life is when I finally realized that I didn't have to have money to make as much money as I could muster in the real estate business. And I'll tell it to you like this. That theory, you know, you don't need money to buy real estate, is real easy for my lips to say, and it's really easy for someone's ears to hear.
Yes.
Including mine at the time. But until it took me 10 years from hearing that to where I owned it. It took about 8-10 years, and then I came to own it. I owned it in my heart, mm-hmm. and I knew exactly what they meant, and I understood it 100%. And it goes something like this. In the early days of investing, you don't need money. What you are, most of us don't start with money, and probably for a good reason, because if we had a lot of money when we started, we'd lose it all.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you become a professional deal finder, and you become a professional at wrapping those deals up on a contract with a little bit of time before it has to close. Now, if I had, you know, if I had a $100,000 house under contract for $45,000, you think I'm going to have any trouble finding the money?
No.
What I have to do is I have to give up half of it, or I have to give up a percent of it to the guy who has the money. So the ad might look something like this on Craigslist. In today's terms, it would be on Craigslist, you know. Have $100,000 house under contract for $45,000. Who wants half the profit? When they call, you say, you know, bring the money.
Bring the money with you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so how many deals can I do now? I can do unlimited. I can do all the deals I can find.
That's true. Yeah, you don't preach it all in your book, but your faith comes through for everyone to see. You did some things that you didn't really want to do because your faith demanded it. Tell me about your faith and how that shaped your career.
Well, I hadn't been to church since I was, you know, since I was a young kid, but I was raised with God, and I was raised that, you know, there's someone that watches and knows what you do, and you know, there's good things to do and there's bad things to do, and I definitely was raised to know the difference between right and wrong. And one of the things that changed my life was when I made a decision based on a prayer that I did. I was sitting on a showroom floor one day, and I asked God for something, and He gave it to me within about 10 minutes. But
wow.
it wasn't exactly what I'd asked for. I had asked for a job that would you please show me a way to make $45,000 a year and I won't waste it, God. I asked Him for that.
Mm-hmm.
And within about 10 minutes, a man called me, and a friend of mine, and he had an offer, but I had to be on the road 90 days at a time and come home for 10 days and then 90 days out again. And then in December, we'd get the month off because we worked in the chain stores and they didn't want us in the stores. And I immediately recognized that I had asked for this job, and when I asked for the pay, I mean, the story's there in the book, but when I asked for the pay, it kind of came around in a subtle way, and it dawned on me that I had just been given exactly what I'd asked for, and it was plain as day,
mm-hmm.
except I hadn't qualified my request that it had to be in town, and I told myself if I didn't take this job that I was going to be a schmuck, and I wouldn't have done what I asked God to give me, He gave me what I asked for, no more, no less. He just gave it to me out of town, and I got to go. And I quit my job that day, and I left on a plane that day.
Wow.
And I spent 5 years on the road, 90 days at a time. I went to every mall in the United States at least two times, and most of them, you know, 10, yeah. 15 times, you know.
I know that was a tough time for you, and I tried to put myself in your shoes, and it kind of goes back to be careful what you wish for. Be sure to phrase what you want. Be very exacting in what your desire is, and get your intention right. There's another thing that comes up throughout your career in real estate, and this comes up time after time in the stories that you tell, that you've been very successful with partnerships and building teams. Is this something that just happened kind of generically, or did you understand the importance of this from the beginning?
Well, it happens kind of generically when you realize that you don't have money and that you're going to have a money partner to get started. So you don't really plan to have partners, but in the way that you can proliferate by giving up a percentage of your deals or half your deal or whatever percent for finding the deal and doing the work, you know, you inherently get these partners. What I didn't calculate was these people that had money were already successful, and I was putting myself right next to them. And therefore, their networks were becoming my network rather quickly. Like, I would learn their roofers, their plumbers, their lawyers, their contracts. Mm-hmm. Their, you know, I was privy to all their stuff because I was on the same team. So all of a sudden, and then I got education from them too, because, you know, they'd say, look, I've been doing this a long time. You probably don't need to add that porch on the back of that place because it's not going to pay. I said, well, okay. You know, and so not only did I get their networks, but I got mentored. You know, I was getting mentored along the way for finding these deals.
You not only got their money, you got their wisdom.
And I got their friendships. And I guess the underlying thing to that is, what's good about houses is that, you know, you can get a partner and you can do one house, and when the house closes out, if it was fun, you can do it again, and if not, you just don't do it again, you know? If someone's too demanding or unreasonable, or if you don't have fun, don't do it again with that person. But I found a lot of people that I did, you know, one guy I did 450 deals with.
Awesome.
And it's twofold, because you can have bad partners, and I had partners that took more from me than I thought was fair.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't spend much time crying about it. I just said, okay, well, I move on to the next partner, I move on to the next deal. And I learned, you know, just like to preface my prayer, I learned to preface some deals, some things about deals before we went into them.
Yeah, exactly. You also give a lot of credit to your parents for their unwavering support and faith in you and in what you were doing. Do you think you would have persevered through the really tough times had you not known they were always there for you? And I guess, what would you say to someone that doesn't have the support of their family?
Well, having a supportive family was, I mean, they never gave me any money. They were there to help me through a crunch, and I could have always gone home. Once I moved out, I never went back home. I guess for those times on the road, I didn't have to have a home. So when I went home for the 10 days, you know, I would stay there. But, I mean, I really was self-sufficient. But it did make a lot of difference on the amount of risk I could take, because I knew at the end of the day that I was single and I didn't have any children. And if I needed a roof and I needed some food, I could, that was always in the back of my mind, that it was always there. And it was very comforting. I would like to think that anyone who's driven or has a dream, and it may even be to their advantage to not even have that, because then their metal gets forged even to a hotter fire.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of the people that don't have parents like that and don't have that net, you can find people, they'll never be close like parents, but you can find people that are great friends and great allies and great support systems outside of that. And some families that I've known, you know, they're better off to find a closeness in other in other places than the family, because the family was so dysfunctional. I've seen people come up both ways. And the people that come up without a family, mm-hmm. are some of the strongest people I've ever met in my life.
Well, I agree with you. I think you need a support network somewhere. I think it's great if it's your family, but it doesn't necessarily have to be your family. But it can be tough if you don't have some sort of network there to support you. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I agree, but sometimes having a really close family that you run to or talk to or everything can work against you because they know you as a boy. They know you as a little girl. They know you yeah. as the way you are, and they try to hold you into this peg. And when you start venturing out to say, I'm going to go buy some houses and I'm going to get into real estate, these same people that are supporting you in a way are working against you because they're advising you, not to go out on these limbs. And, you know, they're trying to protect you. And that can work against you, too. So my parents never told me not to do anything. They just always said, well, good luck. Let us know if you need some help. And, yeah. and you know.
You had very, you know what I'm talking about, smart though? Parents.
Well, you know what I mean, though. Sometimes the last people you want to tell that you're going into the real estate business is all your friends and everything because mm-hmm. they don't know you that way.
Yeah. They think of you as, like you said, of that boy or that girl or that neighbor, not as that business person who's embarking on this venture.
Yeah, I saw it firsthand with my banker, which is still my banker today, but he was my high school quarterback in my high school days. And we hadn't seen each other for 25 years. And one day I walked in the bank and asked for a loan, and he was like, are you crazy? You know, because he knew me from when I was a kid. He didn't know what I had become or what I was capable of. He just knew how I used to be. And so it took me a little while to convince him that I had grown up a lot.
That's a good point. A lot of folks have a spouse that's either not interested in real estate, doesn't want to be in real estate, or they think it's just too risky. In the book, you talk about your wife, Tommy, and what an integral part of the business she has become. But she wasn't always thrilled with real estate and its risks, was she?
No, not to, I had to drag my wife into entrepreneurialism like a caveman. I had to drag her by the back of her hair, you know, behind me. And she was kicking and screaming the whole time, thinking that I was just risking all this stuff. And what compounded it was is that I didn't have money, and I had done enough deals with some people that I felt very confident that I knew how to do this by myself now. And I didn't have money, but back in the day, you could get as many credit cards as your good credit, you know, as many applications as mm-hmm. there were if you had good credit. I amassed like 45, 50 credit cards, and I bought houses on credit cards. And that scared my wife to death. And I wasn't afraid because I knew that, you know, the $10,000 I'd put on this card and the $10,000 I'd put on that card to buy the house was worth, you know, that was $20,000. I knew the house mm-hmm. was worth $50,000. I knew. And it wasn't a guess. It wasn't my estimation. I had all the current market analysis, so I knew exactly what those houses were worth. I knew how many days they stayed on the market. And I knew that if I offered them at a super discount, kind of like wholesaling, although I didn't quite wholesale, mm-hmm. that I would move those houses and get paid back. You know, those credit cards were 18 and 21% at the time, reminiscent of the time they are now. But I was never going to have these houses for that long. And I did my first, let me just say this. It wasn't unusual for me to have $200,000 to $250,000 in credit card debt on any given day in 1996 and 1998. Mm-hmm.
One of the most successful people that I know, real estate investor, has almost the same identical story. And that is what he did. And he would talk often about his success with using the credit cards. But he also said at that time, he was still a detective on the police force. And he said he would come home every night. He'd have to babysit those credit cards and make sure they all got paid on time. And sometimes he would transfer the balances. But it worked at that time. Like you said, back in the day, it was a way a lot of people invested in real estate.
It can still happen now, but, you know, the exit strategies aren't as fast. You know, in the early days, I bought a house, fixed it up, and then simultaneously sold it to someone owner-financed, and in mm-hmm. the same 10 minutes liquidated that note to a note buyer and cashed out. Those days are not here today in the same sense. Like, there's not institutions like associates who were buying these notes, but the secret to my success was, and I would lend this to anyone, is when I borrowed money on a house from a credit card, that credit card got taped into the file of that house, and nothing else went on that credit card. Because imagine if you're buying a house on credit cards, you have no first lien. You own the house free and clear as far as the title companies and everyone else is concerned. And so when I sold the house, I would get the total check for the house. I mean, you know, if I bought the house for $20,000 on credit cards and I sold it for $40,000, I'd go home with a check for $40,000. And the secret was, I just told my wife, I says, now open up that file. You see those credit cards taped in there? I says, call them up, find out what the balances are, and let's pay them off.
Pay it off today.
Pay it off today, because what's left over is ours. And some people would say to me, well, why are you paying them off? Why don't you just leave it on the card and go? I said, because every transaction has to have a beginning and an end, and the end is when you write the final check. Yes. And that leaves my paper trail so that my bookkeepers and so that myself and the IRS can see where I started and where I ended.
That's good, solid business practice.
Yeah, and so like even if I had to pull out a third card just to, you know, that might have had a $10,000 limit on it, I only put like $500 on it. I still taped that card inside there and refused to put anything else on that card because I needed to know clearly where my monies were and where my debts were.
That was a great idea. When did you know that you'd made it, that you had a sustainable business model to build your wealth?
When my passive income exceeded my wants and my needs.
Excellent.
That's the definition of that's one definition. And this you talk about an aha moment or a moment that just really sat me down and said, "Man, I'm right there. I have it now." One step was owning that theory that you didn't have to have money, owning that theory in your heart. The second one, I knew I needed money, but I didn't know what I needed it for. I knew I wanted passive income, but how much did I need? I mean, did I need $5,000 a month? Did I need 10? What 20? Where was it? And then one day I read this sentence. Someone said it. I don't remember where or how. Said, financial freedom happens when your wants and your needs are exceeded by your passive income. When I heard that sentence, it was like I had just been given the map to the Holy Grail. I said, man. The first thing it said to me was, being rich and being financially independent was two different things. Now, before, when I had heard people being financially independent, I thought they were rich. Being financially independent doesn't mean you're rich. It just means that you make more comes in passive than goes out.
And that's
could control the bar. I could control the bar. If I wanted to live in a tent at the lake and limit my overhead to $1,000, then when I had, you know, $1,100 coming in, I was free. I could wake up every day and decide what I wanted to do. Now, I didn't go to that extreme, but I did decide I was going to trim my living down, and I described this in a book called The Moat Theory.
Mm-hmm.
I put everything that I absolutely needed, my house, my car, you know, everything that I absolutely needed to survive in a modest level, and then I drew a circle around it and said, I'm going to go to work until I have more money coming in across the moat into my castle than is going out. And on that day, I'll be free. And at the time, it was $3,500. And so now I had a goal, and I knew exactly what I had to do to be able to call myself financially free. And my task became singular in its purpose, and I knew exactly what I was shooting for. I was going to amass enough rental properties or enough whatever till I had $3,500 a month coming in. And on that day, I would be a free man.
Mm-hmm.
And on that day, I would be able to chase the endeavors and the dreams of my life 24/7, every day, all day long. And that's where the momentum was going to come, is when I could not worry about the bills and just immerse myself.
And that is so important. That's a lesson that everyone needs to learn. That's just well put.
Because what usually happens, right, Sharon, is people make more money, they go out and buy, you know, they increase their overhead. And the secret was to make more and more and more money that's coming in passively, but don't increase your overhead.
Yes.
Because if you do, you just keep moving the barn. You're never free.
Yeah, you're never free. You've got that right.
Now, the moat was paid for, I'm sorry if you don't mind me elaborating this, but
go ahead.
Everything in my moat was paid for, I could take all the extra money that came in, and I could charge out and try things. And if I lost all of it, what I didn't risk was what paid for what provided for my everything inside my moat. I wouldn't risk that. If I had 25 houses that was making this happen, I never put those up for grabs. But I could risk everything else. And if I lost it that year or that month or whatever, I'd come back across the moat, pull my drawbridge up, sit in my castle while everything's being paid for, and say, what did I do wrong?
Uh-huh, and then figure it out and begin again.
Mm-hmm.
So with that having been said, what is the most important piece of advice you would pass on to someone that's just getting started in real estate? Is there anything you would do differently if you could start over again, if you were to start over again?
If I was to start over again, when I started making money, I would have concentrated on paying things off. I've always functioned with today I'm comfortable with like 40 to 50% debt on houses, because we need the power of leverage to excel. Because if you're just going to pay for one house and then go and then focus the next 8 years on paying for the next house, it's too slow. You have to have the power of leverage, which means you got to borrow 20 and put in 20, you know, and that 20 that you borrowed is giving you tremendous leverage. But as I made more and more money and it was stockpiled up, instead of expanding the number of houses I had with debt, I would have, and I am about there now, taking the extra money instead of expanding, borrowing 20 more thousand and adding 20,000 and keep expanding the number, I would have just paid off the units I had. It's the same amount of money coming in. 50 houses with 50% debt is mm-hmm. one set of income.
Mm-hmm.
25 houses with no debt is the same income as the 50, but you got 25 less moving parts.
Yeah, it's a lot less hassle, isn't it? A lot less hassle.
Yeah, and a lot less liability. I mean, they're you know, when a house goes vacant and you don't have a payment, you're not losing much. You know, maybe some insurance or something. Mm-hmm. But when a house goes vacant and you got 50% debt, you're losing, you know, more. So what I would do different.
That's great. That's great advice. Any other words of wisdom before we end this interview that you'd like to pass on to people that I, you know, maybe haven't thought of? Any words of wisdom?
Well, I mean, I'm like I said in the book, I'm the last guy to try to tell anyone how to do anything, because I believe that everyone's circumstances are so unique. But what I think you can do is get with people that have done it already and partner with those people and stay as close to them as you can and understand why they're where they're at. Try to understand why they're financially free and you're not. Try to understand why they got 200 houses paid for and you don't.
And you don't.
And then look at their models and look at the way they live and their path. And also read as much as you can. These days, one of the things that I saw happen, you know, these seminars where you go and you pay and you pay, and then you go to the next seminar and you get on that path and you go to the next seminar. And every seminar you go to, they're going to make you excited about that particular angle. I say get as much free as you can on all the different angles and then narrow it down to one. And before you spend any money, make sure that's the one thing you're going to do. If it's buying and fixing up and flipping, or if it's buying and fixing up and owner financing, if it's wholesaling, figure out the one thing you're going to do, and then don't stray from that until you've made a success out of that one module.
Master one thing before you move on to another.
Right. And like these days, I have 5 different businesses. I have a real estate loan company. I loan money to the investors at 50 cents on the dollar, which is what I would buy a house at. If I have to give it back, I'm not disappointed. You know, I started taking the cash that I made, and I bought mini storages.
Mm-hmm.
I recognize that there's no toilets and no plumbing and no carpet and no sheetrock and no paint, and they were just a lot easier to receive rent from and manage. And plus, I recognize that flipping houses, I tried to make flipping houses into a business where I could run it kind of absentee. The problem was that if anyone got really good at what I was teaching them to do, they didn't need me anymore and they would go on their own. Which
exactly.
is no problem. I'm not for holding people down.
Mm-hmm.
But so I started taking the money that I made, I started buying mini storages, and I could train a manager, and the manager could run it, but they could not necessarily go out and buy the mini storages. You follow
exactly.
me? If I trained people how to buy houses at 50 cents on the dollar, as soon as they learned it, they really didn't need me at all.
But the mini storages are much more passive income. Like you said, you've got no tenants and no toilets. You know, you've got some buildings and some doors and... you need a manager, but they're pretty self-sufficient as far as passive income goes.
Yeah, but the biggest part of what I was saying was that's a business that you can build and sell. I was trying to build a business around flipping, but every time someone got really good at it, they would leave, and I couldn't really make that in, because that business is me. If you're flipping houses, that business is you, and without you, it's not a business. If someone knows how to do what you know how to do, they're not going to accept a paycheck from you. They're going to go out and do it. I could take that cash that I made from that, and I moved it over to mini storages, and I could build a business there that I could train a manager, and I could walk away from that manager, and that manager wasn't about to get up and go buy, you know, 1,000 mini storage units.
Exactly. Well, Mitch, I really want to thank you for all the information you've shared tonight. It's so important for new investors to know that real estate investing won't always be a bed of roses. But if you don't give up and you just keep on working at it and tilling the garden, you will be rewarded in the end. And you are living proof of that. Just keep on keeping on.
I agree with you 100%. I think one of the things that has been touted about the book was that finally, you know, someone had written a book about this endeavor called creative real estate and buying houses and selling them that told all the bad sides of it. And there were some days that I just was really thinking I was going to be crushed. And people find it a little bit refreshing to get both sides of the story, you know? The rest of the story, Paul Harvey would say.
That is the one thing that really struck me is, you know, everyone is tells of their successes, but there aren't a whole lot of people that tell about all the struggles and all the times they got knocked down. And it's important for people to know that this is just a part of learning this business. And that's I loved about your book.
Yeah, for example, when was the last time you went to a seminar and they said, well, over here we got, you know, where you can buy houses and fix them up and rent them out. And over here we got where you can buy houses and wholesale them. And then over here we got how to deal with your spouse who thinks you're nuts. I mean, you know, there's not a seminar on that, but it's real life. There's most of the time, a lot of the times, I see the spouses in conflict over the business because it's, you know, it's not for both people at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is how do you handle major upsets in your life when something just tragic happens? What are you going to do? I mean, you can, if you're going to give up your dreams when life throws the wrench in the gears, then don't even start, because I can guarantee you life is going to throw the wrenches in the gears. And so kind of inadvertently what I did, and I had asked my editor, and I'd asked several people who read the book before I put it out, I said, you know, am I putting too much personal stuff in here? Because, you know, do people really want to hear about this? And they would say, man, this is what's making it. This is life. This is the difference between your book and everyone else's. Is you're telling them, you know, not everyone's circumstance is going to be the same, but they're all going to have something like this.
Yeah, and I agree. I agree completely. I think the personal aspect of it is what makes it stand out from other books of its type. And I've have to tell anyone that hears this interview, I highly recommend this book. I absolutely loved it. It's easy to read, and the fact that it is so personal just makes it a great book. So I thank you for taking the time to write the book, Mitch.
I thank you for calling me and having this interview and allowing me to maybe reach some of the people that I would never have reached before through your network. And hopefully some of the people on my network will learn about your blog. Your blog is Louisville Gals Real Estate Blog.com. Is that what it is?
That's correct.
And I highly suggest that blog. And while we're there, let me just tell you where you can read about my book or order the book. It's at 1000houses.com. That's 1000houses.com. There you can read over 70 reviews, which I copied from Amazon, and I'll tell you that the book's available now on Amazon, and I just got it into ebooks with Smashwords and Barnes and Nobles, and I just got I'll have ebooks up on Amazon here soon. And you can buy the paperback book from anywhere you want, but I'll tell you this, if you order directly from my site, I'll be, as always, right up front, I make a little bit more money than if you order from those other places. But in return, I'll get you an autographed copy, and I will get you a 19-song CD of the music in the book, and I'm not even going to try to explain that to you. You'll just have to figure out why there's music in my book. I'm not even going to try to explain it. But you will get a 19-song CD of songs written by yours truly or co-written by me. And other than that, you can order anywhere you want to. There's going to be some benefits to ordering the e-books. And I'll tell you what, if you order from my site and you'll actually give me your real phone number, there's about a 99% chance that I'm going to call you.
And that's exactly how we met.
And thank you. Yeah, that's how I met Sharon. She downloaded the 100 pages. I give the first 100 pages of my book away free. I ask for your name and your phone number and your email address. And, of course, I can't verify if your phone number is real or not. But if you give me your real phone number, you're probably going to get a call from me. The reason why I do it is, in this day of super bad customer service everywhere you go, I tried to ask myself, what can I do? And I said, I don't know exactly what I can do, but I can call a person that downloads the first 100 pages of my book for free and thank them. And I'll give you my personal email address. And if you want to talk real estate or ask a question, I'll do my very best to answer it.
And I can vouch for the CD. It's great. In fact, my daughter, who's a country music fan, promptly stole it from me, and it's in her vehicle now. So great music there. And she loves it so much that she claimed it. So there you go.
I'll have to get you an extra one for you yourself. So I'll send one out to you. I'll send you a couple, so you'll have one.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Mitch, so much for doing this interview.
Thank you. I've had a great time.
Me too. Good night.
Good night.